Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And hello out there to all you Brooklyn folk and beyond. Happy Father's Day weekend. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Bedford and Sullivan podcast, the podcast that keeps you, the audience, active listeners in the Brooklyn Dodgers TV series research process. And we're always thrilled to talk to the gentleman I have on the line, and we're going to be talking a little bit about his fatherhood, if you will, with this weekend coming up, and that is Mr. Carl Erskine of Anderson, Indiana. What's going on, Carl? How are you?
Hey there. Good morning, Sam. Well, we're having a beautiful day in Indiana, and it's going to be warm, but we're doing fine. Betty, my sweet wife of 73 years, she's doing well as well.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that, and we're going to be going into what your biggest legacy between the two of you, of course. Everybody appreciates what you've done on the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Los Angeles Dodgers. When it all comes down to it, that's just a game. The type of father you have been and your fatherhood over the course of your life, you know, that is the most important thing. That's the most important legacy for sure. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. Of course, we've talked about your children at certain points on the podcast, but wherever you want to start with fatherhood and give our audience a rundown of your family history.
Okay, well, thank you then. Fortunately, I was had two brothers older than me. They were good athletes, both of them, and my dad had been an athlete before that, back in the late 1800s. He was a semi-pro player, and he had a very good throwing arm. And even I was born the third in the line of these three boys. So my dad was probably close to 40 when I was born, but he could still throw. He loved to throw, and he worked in managed a grocery store. And the story goes that the train that used to go by on an angle behind the store, when the old freight train was going by, his buddies would run over and say, Matt, hey, grab a couple apples, get out there. And they would bet on him throwing at the numbers on the boxcars as they were going by. And when we'd go to county fair, after I got big enough to remember, we'd go to county fair, my dad would never get past a dunk tank. And he'd buy three balls and knock the guy in the water about two out of three. And they'd buy three more. I think he spent his whole paycheck throwing at the guy and knocking him in the water. Anyway, well, I had a good growing up years. My memories are of playing catch with my dad and brothers by the side of the house. And we had a barn in the back, and we played burnout. Now, you probably can figure that out. You start tossing each other nice and easy, but every throw got a little harder. Of course, I was the youngest, and they would pin me back to the old barn, throwing hard, and I would reach up real high to throw hard back, and that's how I think I got my straight overhand delivery, throwing with my brothers and my dad, me trying to throw as hard as they could throw, and a good childhood. Started my baseball career in a park league when I was 9 years old. And we played on a regular-sized diamond because Little League hadn't come in yet. And I got a brand-new ball glove my dad bought me. It was kind of a nice yellow color. And a kid wanted to borrow it in between innings. And he was big. And I was 9. He was 12. His name was Chet Porter, because I got to know him real well later. He was chewing tobacco. And he wanted to borrow my glove. I said, no, this is brand new. My dad just said, no, give me that glove. He said, I'll punch you in the face. Well, he threatened me.
Oh,
I handed him the glove, and he pounded on it a couple times, and then he took a big spit right in the middle of the pocket, and that yellow glove turned dark brown where he spit. And I owned that glove for a long time, and it, of course, got dirty and all that, but that spot where he spit never hit. It was always the darkest. So as long as I had that glove, I always saw that big spit. I got to know him as we grew up. And
oh, it's a bit of a tangent that I'm going to go on real quick, considering what we're talking about. But I'm just curious. It didn't seem like you were ever a big tobacco a chewer. It just, since it was such a big thing in baseball, you could really see any photo that you would cue in to see of your era. You can tell when somebody is a tobacco chewer because they got that big wad in their mouth. It didn't seem like you ever were. Did you ever get into that?
No, I never did. Coaches, when you're growing up, they tell you can't smoke and you can't drink a lot of stuff, a lot of pop and all that. Lay off of it. That's not good for you. Well, I believed that. And although my brother smoked, my dad smoked, and my dad chewed tobacco. But no, I never had an idea to go that way. In fact, what little bit I tried as a youngster, I didn't like it anyway. But in baseball, when I came into baseball professionally, a lot of guys chewed. It was just typical for a player to have a wad in his jaw. But they banned that eventually because of tongue cancer, lip cancer, a lot of.
Yeah, right.
And you're too young, Sam, probably to know that it was a tradition years ago that when the last out was made on the infield, the infielders would not take the glove into the dugout. They would turn, like the shortstop, he would just turn and sail his glove back on the grass behind the shortstop position. Third baseman did it. Second baseman did it. And I'm not sure about the first base. Anyway, it was just a custom. Now, that lasted until the early 50s. And all the time that I played in the early years, the gloves, they just sail them out and leave them on the field. And what would happen when the other team would go out, these gloves were laying there, and oftentimes the shortstop or second baseman, they would pick up this glove and take a wad of tobacco and stuff it up one of the fingers of the glove and throw it back on the ground. So the next inning, you could see the shortstop or second baseman between pitches trying to dig that chew out of the finger of his glove.
The original trolling, as the kids like to say now.
Yeah, right. So, well, that lasted. They finally, tobacco was finally banned. But now I watched some baseball today, and I can always tell when a guy has snuff. They don't chew big mm-hmm. wads of tobacco, but they got snuff down in that lower part of their jaw, and you can see that little lump in there, and you can always tell. Now, that's actually illegal, but guys get by with it.
So I'm wondering, of course, to become a father, you have to have met Betty. So before we start talking about your children, if you could give us the story of how you met Betty. I'm sure that we've talked about it before, but I don't know whether I've directly asked you to elaborate.
I was 15 years old, and I got my first bicycle. So I'm tooling around the neighborhood with my buddies, and one of them, he was a little tiny guy, a little short, he was young. His name was Mouse. The nickname in the neighborhood was Mouse. So Mouse said to me one day, "Do you want to meet a pretty girl?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Let's go." So he took me down. I lived on 14th Street. So he took me down on West 5th Street. And here's this sweet little girl. She was 14 years old. She was up on the porch, and I pulled up there, and we spoke, Matt, and somehow the bell started ringing, and it was my bicycle. So that was my first girl experience. And so, you know, I never had another girlfriend besides Betty from age 14. And I know her homeroom teacher at school, when we would walk around the halls holding hands or whatever, Mrs. Lashbrook told Betty to the side, "Now you stay away from that black-headed boy." So I'd like to find Mrs. Lashbrook to tell her we've been married 73 years.
Exactly.
So Betty and I dated through school. I went in the Navy when I graduated from high school. I was in the Navy for a while, and when the war ended, I got out, and about a year later, I was in the minors. Well, as soon as I got out, Mr. Rickey signed me, and I went to the minor leagues in Danville, Illinois, was the minor league team for the Dodgers. And it was about 110 miles from where I lived in Anderson, Indiana, over Illinois. So my mother and dad, Betty's mother and dad, they would come over every time I pitched at Danville. At the end of that season, I gave her the ring. And Mr. Rickey wanted me to go to Cuba to play in the Winter League. And I said, "I can't go. I'm getting married in October. Move your date up and take your wife with you. We'll pay her expenses, too." So Betty and I went to Cuba on our honeymoon. We were there 4.5 months. And really, it's a whole other story, but that experience in that Winter League in Cuba, which I would say was probably double A or triple A class, a lot of good baseball in Cuba at that time, maybe still. But we went there 4.5 months, and that experience there, had two things happened. Betty got pregnant pretty quick, and I also worked on my curveball in Cuba. And when I came back to spring training, the coaches were all astounded at the curveball I developed. And that really hustled me. The Dodgers had 200 pitchers in their system. And, boy, I thought, how am I going to beat out all these guys? But, you know, that curveball developed so quick for me. And I had a good fastball. And Mr. Rickey loved young players who could throw hard, but who had the aptitude to embellish their talent. They weren't just a raw, hard thrower. They could finesse the pitches off speeds and still have that hard fastball. And I could do that, and Mr. Rickey moved me up through. He leapfrogged me over 200 pitchers. And I only spent and they brought me to the big league. So that trip to Cuba with my new bride and getting that curveball to work like I wanted it, two of the major things of my life happened on that trip to Cuba.
And when thinking about Branch Rickey, Mr. Rickey, of course, was very much of the book, and he loved it. Based on what I'm reading, it seemed like he really appreciated when a ball player, as opposed to Leo DeRocher. Now, even though Leo DeRocher was married, of course, he seemed to get around, or so the story goes. Actually, so the quote from Leo goes, really. So when it came to you and other younger ball players, Mr. Rickey loved it when you were settling down early.
He encouraged. We'd have one-on-one meetings with Mr. Rickey, and a major league owner was surprised. He'd ask us at least two questions. Mr. Rickey would probe to say, "What's your father's hobby? What do you do in the off season? Do you go to church? Do you have a girlfriend?" Mr. Rickey was always probing what your character was like, and he, as an owner, and had almost 800 players under contract through the whole minor leagues, 26 farm teams. But he always wanted young players. He knew he was a young man himself at one time. He knew with a little money in your pocket, staying in a big hotel, traveling around the country, that there was a lot of temptations. So his advice to almost every player he talked to, young player like me, do you have a girlfriend? He encouraged his players to get married, assuming that that would be a stabilizing force for all the temptation that would come traveling around so much. So, yes, and I always felt like that one of the things that tipped the scales toward Jackie Robinson's being selected for the first black player was Rachel, his wife. Rachel was a beautiful lady. It still is, a matter of fact. I think she's in her mid-90s at least. But Rachel had a stabling effect on Jackie, and Mr. Rickey wisely understood that Jackie would be off the field a lot more than he would be on the field. So all the hours away from the diamond, he knew that Rachel was a real stabilizing force in Jackie's life. And so that was a tipping point, I think, for Mr. Rickey to pick Jackie.
Right.
The first black player.
And it's funny that you're mentioning it, because I was just talking with somebody who was mentioning the story of, I think it was Clyde Stukeforth, who I believe it was a minor league game, and or it might have been a Negro League game, and he saw Rachel with the other wives, and he went back to Mr. Rickey and said, if the man is good enough for Rachel Robinson, he's good enough for us.
Yeah, that story was Buzzy Bavese, who
I got the name wrong. I'm so sorry.
No, I just happened to have heard that story as well. Buzzy Bavese went to, I believe it was Montreal, when wherever it was, he saw Rachel, again, a beautiful lady, very dignified lady, well-educated. Rachel had a degree in a nursing degree, I believe, and so she was an intelligent person. And it's interesting, if you don't mind me digressing just a little bit here, I got to know Mrs. Babe Ruth quite well, because I was involved in the league called Babe Ruth Baseball, and I was on the board. And I got to know Mrs. Babe Ruth quite well. And I'd go with her on various functions, and she never had her own identity. She was always Babe Ruth's wife. Tell me about Babe. Did Babe really do this? Did Babe really eat two loaves of bread and two bottles of ketchup and two steaks and all these things that were told about Babe Ruth? And so I got the feeling she doesn't have a life of her own. She had no identity. She's Babe Ruth's wife, and so everything revolves around what Babe did. Rachel was just the opposite. She was Jackie's wife, but she was a force of her own. She stood as a woman that was her own. She was her own gal, and it was a contrast on how the two handled a famous husband. And in case of Rachel Robinson, Rachel was devoted to Jackie, his best critic, and his best support. But she was a good advisor to Jackie under all the pressure that he had, and he had to control his temper. Rachel Robinson was a factor, a big factor. And Mr. Rickey, when he met Rachel, he must have said, this is the whole package. This guy can play. This guy's smart. This guy has a beautiful, solid wife and home life. And, you know, I don't think that ever was explored much with the writers of how much Rachel, off the field and in other pressure situations, how much she contributed to Jackie's ability to hold his temper, and he never fought. There's no record any place where he ever fought in a clubhouse, a parking lot, a restaurant, any place. Amazing, because Jackie was actually a militant makeup, but Mr. Ricky's guidance and the bonding that they had and the commitment that Jackie made that I won't fight, that made that experiment successful.
And as they try to figure out when to play baseball, when they're going to play baseball, I really hope that they have a specific day that basically recreates what they would have done on April 15th with everybody wearing number 42. And we give our best out there of safe and health to Mrs. Robinson. It's remarkable, all these stories, Carl, and so many different places to go, so many different characters involved. It's both so fascinating and so daunting to get to all of it. And I cannot thank you enough for being here for me and for being here for our audience to be able to go through this. And where I want to go next, of course, is your own family. If you could remind us how many kids you have, and also start from the beginning. When was your first kid born?
Yes. Well, early in our marriage, because I just mentioned on our trip to Cuba, 4.5 months, Betty got pregnant. So my first son was born in 1948, Danny, my oldest son. And 2 years later, Gary came along. And then about 3 years later, my daughter Susan came along. And then my kids grew up around the clubhouse. My two boys especially, I'd take them often on a Saturday into Devitt's Field clubhouse. And they got to know all the players. And what was interesting in New York at that time, of course, with three teams in New York, my boys also saw on TV, saw Willie Mays play, and then some Yankee players play. So my boys knew the Dodgers just like nothing. But, boy, they were fascinated. So one of my boys was a Willie Mays fan, and the other one was a Mickey Mantle fan. And so I tell them, don't say too much in the clubhouse.
Yeah, don't say anything in front of Duke, please. Go.
Well, we had a lot of fun kidding about that, but my boys was fortunate to get to, and in those days security was not anywhere close to what it is today. So you could bring friends in the clubhouse, and the guys did, and the other players, you talk about how people bond with each other, and oftentimes they talk in terms of family, like the team is like a family. Well, let me tell you, young players, as the Dodgers had many of, and when I went up, I was 21, and there was a lot of young players on the Dodgers team, all having families, and there were dads, a lot of dads on the teams. They bring their they wouldn't bring their girls, but they'd often bring their boys to the clubhouse. So not only did we play together, we grew up together, sort of, and we raised our families together. Picnics on an off day was a big family day with everybody's kids, and it was just a range of ages, too. But my boys were very familiar with Ebbets Field. And one time, Saks Fifth Avenue had a big promotion on Father's Day. And they said to me, would you and your son, Danny, your oldest son, would you take a picture for Father's Day? And so they made a Dodger uniform for Danny. He was 3 years old. They made a full Dodger uniform for Danny. Just like mine, and then they took a picture of us playing catch or something, and so family was a part of the bonding of that team. and played together. You know, we played together 10, maybe 12 years, most of us. And
yeah.
So we did truly have a family bonding there. The wives were close. Met on the play bridge when the team's on the road. A lot of the wives would get together. So as we played through, I was in the league 12 seasons, and as we played through each season, our families grew up together. So it was truly thinking about Father's Day. we truly had a bunch of young fathers on the Dodgers.
So how did your kids take the move to Los Angeles?
Yeah, they were probably about 8 years old and 6 years old, the two boys. Well, when we got to L.A., we lived in Lakewood the first summer in '58, and they got on teams in the park, and so they just adapted really easy to the move to Los Angeles. And I was there two seasons. So we got acquainted with a few people, but the boys both played in Little League in Los Angeles. So they didn't miss much making the move. They just kind of adapted right into it.
Was there any frustration? Did they ask you a lot of questions about it at first, you know, when hearing that the Dodgers were, especially growing up in Brooklyn, they must have had some sort of emotional connection with the other families, not just the other families of the ballplayers, but also within Brooklyn confines?
Well, you're right, because we lived in a section of Brooklyn called Bay Ridge. And the neighbors, it was like a small town. Bay Ridge was, you know, we knew the barber, we knew the butcher, we knew the baker, the deli guy, and cab drivers. It was like Anderson, Indiana, is a relatively small town. Well, Brooklyn, to us, from the Midwest, It became another small town within a big city. So the move was leaving a lot of friends, babysitters, neighbors, and it was a big adjustment. And we lived in Lakewood the first summer in Los Angeles, and the boys got acquainted pretty quick with the neighbor kids, and I think they had less problem adjusting to the move than some of the players. The boys of summer, as the nucleus of that team was called, the boys of summer, probably most of us had already had our best years in Brooklyn. I played 10 seasons in Brooklyn, and all my best days were already behind me by the time we moved in '58. I did get to pitch the opener in Los Angeles. Coliseum was where we played the games in '58 and '9. I think maybe 3 years before Dodger Stadium was built. But I got to pitch, surprisingly, was picked to pitch the opener in Los Angeles against the Giants, and in a football stadium. And so it was a big day, and had the actual attendance was 79,000 or something. It had over 80,000 counting all the comps and the press and everything. So it was a strange move, a strange opening day, and a strange crowd. It was a lot of movie stars. It was showed up. They were more a piece of a history than an opening day, the way it had been in Brooklyn. But it was just something you had to do, and you just had to make the adjustment. And we played poorly the first year in L.A. too. I was in the Dodger organization 14 years, and I never played in any of those seasons below second place. We either won the league minor leagues, major leagues. But to move to L.A., we just were not together. We didn't play well. And in an eight-team league, we finished seventh. Now, that was a strange feeling to play on a team that was not in contention. But, a lot of – so 58 was a poor season for our first in L.A. And,
Before we get back to your family, my question, what do you think affected your overall numbers the most in 1958 and then also, as well in 1959?
Well, personally, I was at the end of my career, and I'd had a lot of arm trouble, and it was still dogging me. I didn't win many games in Los Angeles, I was not effective. And I knew it. I felt it. So in 59, I went in and told Buzzy Bavese, our general manager, Buzzy, I talked to Alston first, the manager. I said, you know, I'm just not productive, and I'm not being able to be used like I should because my arm's not sound, and so I think I'm just going to hang him up. Well, Duke tried to talk me out of it. He was my roommate, and Drysdale and two or three guys on the team said, you can't quit, Carl, and you can't quit. I said, you know, when you get to the point where you're not productive, you can't stay there. It's a given. If you make the big leagues, which is tough to do, but the tougher part is to stay there, because once you make it, you have to be productive or you don't have a job. You got to go back to the minors and either get better, or that to be the end of your big league career. So I knew I was not productive. The Dodgers have been very generous with me to go along with my arm trouble. But I got to the point where I knew I just was not effective. So I told Buzzy Bavese, our general manager, you're going to have to let me go, because I just feel like I had. So I put on the I said, what are my choices? And the choice I finally took was voluntarily retiring. So Bavese said to me, Carlos, on June 15th, we're right in the middle of the season, so I'm not going to release you. I'm going to make you a coach, and you can work your contract out the rest of the season in 59. So that's what I did. And you know what? Roger Craig replaced me on the pitching staff. He won 11 games the second half of the season. So that was a big contribution to the win, winning the World Series against the White Sox that year. So finishing seventh in 58 and winning the World Series in 59, that was a story with the move to Los Angeles.
Well, I think you guys spoiled L.A. You know, Brooklyn had to wait like 71 years for a world championship, and then you guys got L.A. in two.
That's right.
It's just like that's the way life works, ain't it? Remind me again of your daughter's name, and how old was she at this point?
Susan was about 3 years old when we moved to L.A. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Susan's now a grandmother of eight, and. She's manages an office in Albany, Georgia, and she's a sweet little girl. And I didn't have any trouble with age when I got to be 50, 60, 70, and so forth. But what shook me up, sweet little daughter Susan became a grandmother. I couldn't factor that in.
Yeah, it didn't compute for you. Yeah. Let's go into your family life post 1959, post retirement in the World Series.
Well, I can remember driving home cross country at the end of the 59 season, and we stopped at all the tourist attractions and came back to Anderson, Indiana. All my opportunities after baseball were somewhere besides Anderson, Indiana. I got some real good offers to stay in baseball. The expansion was going on right then, and the Mets were a new team. They offered me two or three ways to come back and be a part of the New York scene. My fourth child, the day, let's see, 1960, that was my first season out of baseball, and Betty was pregnant again. And on April 1st of 1960, my little guy, Jimmy, was born. And in the hospital, I sensed something was not right. And I asked the doctor, is my little guy, Jimmy, is he okay? And they said, well, why don't you take him to Riley Hospital in Indianapolis, a children's hospital, and have him fully examined and evaluated. Well, that was almost a dodge because I knew all these doctors are good friends of mine, and they didn't want to tell me that Jimmy was born, and listen to this harsh word, mongoloid. That
right.
was the term for Down syndrome now, which is Down syndrome. Well, Jimmy, my little guy Jimmy, was born, and he was Down syndrome. And so what a shocker. So I just had to take a wise move and stay in my hometown with my family and not take one of these good offers I was getting for some expansion teams, for the Mets. The Mets offered me not only a pitching coach job, but when I said I couldn't do that, they said, well, how about broadcasting, would you? And mm-hmm. Ralph Kiner got the spot that I might have gotten.
Oh, wow.
And he stayed for a long time with the Mets. But I had to step out of baseball and stay home because my oldest child was 12, and Jimmy brand new, and we didn't know what experience we were going to have with Jimmy. But, you know, Betty was so strong. They advised us, the good doctors in those days, advised us that we should put Jimmy in a good institution where he would be well cared for. And here was the key verse, and it won't interrupt your family. It won't disrupt your family. That was a feeling about a child with some disabilities, mental disabilities or physical. It was kind of a scar on the family. And so families withdrew. There was nothing in the mainstream for a child with disabilities, no school, no services, and good doctors had no place to refer a family with a child and it was a special needs child. But Betty, she almost put two fists up and said, I'm not putting this guy in any, my little guy in any. I carried this guy for 9 months. He's going home with us. Well, I went home that day and I set my three kids down on the Davenport and I told them about their new little brother, that he was going to need lots of help. He wouldn't be able to ride a bike as quick or swim or some of the things they did. And my kids, from day one, they were so supportive of Jimmy. Now, a lot of years have passed since those days when Jimmy was brand new. We had special ed came in when he was 12. He got to actually go to school. And Jimmy grew up in Special Olympics. He was a swimmer. He's track and field. He's a bowler now. He's a pretty good bowler. And so Jimmy has been given a life that was so different than most kids born earlier than Jimmy. Over the centuries, people who had a disabled child usually withdrew from the mainstream of society because their child didn't fit in any place. Well, in Jimmy's lifetime, the world has turned around. Unfortunately, Jimmy has had friends all over the place. He went to some 40-some camps with me, to the fantasy camp for the Dodgers. He knows more high rollers in the United States than you can count. All these doctors and attorneys, all that came to the fantasy camps, they all got to know Jimmy. And so Jimmy's had a wonderful life. He works at Applebee's Restaurant, and he just got an award March 1st for being there 20 years. And
wow.
Works before they open. Now, Jimmy's quite limited, and he needs lots of support. But society today sees a Downs person. They embrace them. They include them. They're almost singled out as a special person, which they are. And so Jimmy's life has been so different than it might have been. But all the wonderful changes have happened. And now we have lots of services for special needs people. Besides special education, there's group homes, there's job placement. The whole world has turned around for Jimmy. And if he'd been born 20 years earlier, he'd have had a very different life. But
I always think of the story that you've told before, but I'd love for you to tell it again, about Walter O'Malley on opening day with Jimmy. And if there's any way you could remind us also, if you remember, what year that was.
Well, that year had to be the mid-60s. I don't know exactly which year, but Jimmy was probably 12 years old, and the Dodgers had invited me back many times to functions, and so this was one of the invitations I had to come back for a Dodger weekend, and we were in the Dodgers' special suite. Mr. O'Malley had other guests there besides us, and he was trying to be the real host. Asking everybody what they needed. So they had a kitchen in this suite. So he was going back to the kitchen and fixing sandwiches or hot dogs or whatever. So he came to us and said, well, now, what's the Erskines going to like to have? And Jimmy, he said, Jimmy, would you like to have a hot dog? And Jimmy said, two. He wanted two hot dogs. So Walter O'Malley, in the middle of a major league game, he's back in the kitchen fixing Jimmy two hot dogs and bringing them out and presenting them to him. And so that's a good example of how Jimmy's life was changed by the way society accepted and included him and others like him. And so it took a long time. But for centuries, people like Jimmy was not included, and they were excluded. In fact, there was a lot of taboo and superstition about a family that had a special child, and they just withdrew from the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
In Jimmy's lifetime, now I wrote a little book. It's called A Parallel. And what the parallel was not a published book, just commercially. I had it, I wrote it, and the parallel is about my 9 seasons watching how Jackie Robinson changed society and changed our culture, really, and all the changes that Jackie and his race represented. But after playing 9 seasons with Jackie, now I've lived a lifetime with Jimmy, and I saw lots of parallels between how Jackie's race didn't fit in for a long time, and Jackie made big headway before Martin Luther King even. Now, living with Jimmy and bringing him up through the culture of the times, I saw the same thing happen with Jimmy and his population. The whole culture begin to change. People begin to be accepted. Schools happened, and so I call the little book I wrote The Parallel, and it's a story of my 9 seasons with Jackie and my lifetime with Jimmy. And I just donated the book to Indiana Special Olympics for their donors. But it's a little hardback book. You can't buy it in a bookstore. You have to get it online by giving a donation to Special Olympics. And then you get a hardback book called The Parallel. And so I'm real proud of that little book because it does explain a huge cultural change affected by Jackie and what he did and all the special people that represented by Jimmy.
So, and I just want to let the audience once more know, Erskine Green Training Institute, you can go to ErskineGreenInstitute.org and you can donate and receive Carl Erskine's book, The Parallel. I'm right here on the website now, and I will certainly do so myself, Carl. Thank you. I guess I'll frame it this way. In talking about fatherhood, what did you? It's a 3-part question. So answer it however you will. What did you know about fatherhood? What did you hear about fatherhood going into your first experience, your first kid? What has fatherhood taught you? And what has raising Jimmy also taught you, the challenges of that about fatherhood?
Well, you know, we're all affected by our own environment and your own family. My father, I had great respect for my father. He was a hardworking man, and in those days, paycheck to paycheck, and but he took time with me and my brothers. We fished together. We hunted together. We went to sporting events together. And my dad, I can always remember when I was a small, maybe 8 years, 6 years old, my dad worked at a General Motors plant eventually after he was manager of a grocery store. He had a black lunch bucket. And he walked to work about 2 miles from where we lived. He walked to work every day, and he walked home about 4 o'clock in the evening. And he always came with that black lunch bucket. And he had always saved me something from his lunch. I mean, if he had an apple or whatever, he always saved me something. And I couldn't wait for my dad to get home and see what he had in his lunch bucket for me. And so we had that kind of a relationship. So that shaped my view of what a father ought to be. And when my first son, Danny, was born, I tried to be as much like my dad, always keeping my kids in mind, always making them feel like I loved them, and I always had a surprise for him. So I think I always thought my dad, and next to my dad, influence was Mr. Rickey. Branch Rickey had a great influence on me for a faith life and a controlled life for a good lifestyle. And then I was very, very affected not to influence my kids the wrong way. So having a family helped me look straight at myself. You know, one of the charges in the Bible is examine yourself. And I always thought about that. Examine yourself. Don't be critical of somebody else so much. Just look at what your life's like and how you're handling it. And that, my kids were responsible for me feel that way after my own father's good example. So it's just responsibility of being a father, being a provider, then setting an example. Don't tell your kids to do one thing and you do something else. Try to live out the discipline in your life that you want your kids to be. So, yeah, it's a learning experience. My wife and I now, we smile because we have a big family. And I said, well, Betty, remember, this all started when I kissed you in the back seat of the car. And I so it's a learning experience being a parent and a father, but I try to take the leadership role in the family of setting a lifestyle that was honorable. And we have always had a faith life. We've been, the church has been important to us all the time. And Mr. Ricky, even himself, a good Christian, he had his own way of teaching the young players about handling pressure and the disciplines that it took. So those two men, my dad and Mr. Ricky, they were the best coaches I could have on how to be a good father.
And I know that, you know, everything I've been reading about Ricky says that a lot of times he would speak to you in stories, and it wouldn't always, he sometimes would have to explain what the moral was, and sometimes he wouldn't. It would be obvious. It would be obvious. But is there any recollection you have of a story he told to try to teach you something?
Yeah, I can give you a good example. Mr. Ricky one time, he did a lot of one-on-ones with his players in his office. But Mr. Ricky one time told me, he held up a baseball, and he said, Carl, you know, life takes discipline. And I recommend all my players to have a faith life, to sit in a place of worship where they can concentrate on the values of life, can read about Christ and what he taught. And he said, look, see this baseball? The Christian life, he said, is just like this red thread. This red thread holds this baseball together. And that's the way a faith life will do. It'll hold your life together just like this red thread. And I couldn't help but stand on a mound when I was a young pitcher, rubbing the ball and under a lot of pressure with the bases loaded or whatever. And I'd look at that baseball and those red stitches. And I'd say, thank you, Mr. Ricky. Thank you for giving me the confidence that you've given me to put me where I'm at. And, you know, that was a great lesson for me, simple as it was. And I've often used it in talking to young people.
And it's so interesting when you think about the feeling of a baseball then, you know, again, a little bit of a tangent, but nowadays it's all, you know, by the book, each baseball is more or less the same. I'm guessing it's not hand stitched, but at the time, you know, did you notice how different each baseball was?
Oh, absolutely. No question. Unknown and unseen by the fans, a pitcher gets a new ball, and there's an automatic way that the pitcher rolls the ball around his hand and feels the stitches. And there's always a better place. Balls have a tolerance. They're not perfect. And they are all, I think they may still be hand-stitched. I'm not sure about that. But
yeah, actually, that's a good question.
Well, they never figured out how to machine-stitch a ball. They've tried several ways to get a machine-stitched ball. I think they've always had to go back to hand-stitched baseballs. And I know it's done in Puerto Rico or somewhere now. Mostly, but yeah, every baseball has its own personality. It has its own feel. And a pitcher just by, you don't have to look at it. You can just hold it and feel it and feel the seams, and you can quickly, within a few seconds, you can figure the best spot on the ball for your particular pitch. And occasionally you'll see a pitcher get a new ball, he'll hold it for a few minutes, short time, and then he'll call for another one. He'll throw it out because sometimes stitches are flat and you just don't feel good for a grip. And so, yeah, each ball is rubbed up by the umpires before the game as to take the shine off of the ball so it's not as slick. But every ball you get is different.
And by the way, yeah, according to what I just looked up on Google, all baseballs are still hand sewn.
Yeah.
So remarkable.
Well,
look at that.
I think they've tried over time. They've tried to find a way to get a machine-stitched baseball, but they've never found one that really was efficient. And so that confirms what I have always thought, that they've gone now back to hand stitching.
And I'd like to leave with this in some fashion. You know, recently we had a Perry Barber, who is a lady umpire in the minor leagues, and you know it was on our Mets podcast, and we were talking about how we can understand athletics. I can understand athletics being separate, and maybe one day I think baseball especially has the ability to be integrated from a sex standpoint, just based off of certain positions. I think women could probably pitch rather well at the major league level. But, you know, umpiring, there's nothing that ever screams that a man has to do it, which was interesting to go into with her. But other than that element of it, I'm curious from your fatherhood experience whether Susan ever showed an inclination for athletics from a baseball perspective, whether you ever had a catch with her, because, of course, traditionally it's always been about the father and the son when we think of the baseball nostalgia of America. But it more and more, I think it is starting to wither away some of that tradition, and the father's relationship with their daughters in baseball is coming more to the forefront.
Well, yeah, I can confirm that because even at my age, I still get a lot of mail. Now I answer my mail, so that perpetuates more mail, but I get a lot of letters from fathers and sons and fathers and daughters who use the baseball cards, the old bubblegum cards. They're still producing those cards. And fathers and sons, fathers and daughters now are bonding using the cards of the past and for the youngsters, players of current times. And so it's become a real obvious bonding between fathers and sons and fathers and daughters. And now I get mail from girls, ladies sometimes, who'd followed baseball or have been in school writing about Jackie Robinson. And so, yes. The girls are absolute, well, in all sports now, girls have excelled, and they certainly are great athletes. Before, girls never got a chance, but now that they're
right
in all sports. And I think there's a chance that sometime, I know, I'm pretty sure that the NBA has women officials.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Positive to that, yeah. And in the minor leagues, I think we've had some female umpires. But, yeah, I think that will happen.
And it's interesting, though. I think it also speaks to the old boys club, if you will, the fact that, you know, like you said, NBA is already, I've seen a lot of women officials out there, but every single official in Major League Baseball is still man.
Yeah, right. Well, tradition dies hard, so and baseball has a lot of tradition to it, and so it's always been a men's game, and it's always been a men's umpiring, but there'd be no reason why women couldn't umpire, and I think it'll happen. And it's just the culture, you know, about every generation or so, the culture adjusts to some of those things.
Right.
Some of them die slow, and it doesn't seem like that's the way to go. But actually, not only have women become prominent in almost every industry, men have become stay-at-home fathers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a twist.
Yeah. No, it is. It's amazing to see the way that society responds to itself. And we're, you know, especially right now, we're seeing everything unfold at such a rapid pace. But without bringing up some of the non-baseball related stuff going on, I will tie it into baseball with the way they have to respond to the COVID crisis. So I'd be remiss if we got to the end of this podcast without asking you what your opinion is of the negotiations going on as a former player, especially a former player that was around before the union existed. What is your opinion about the fact that they don't seem to be able to come to terms with how to get baseball back?
Well, you know, if the games don't happen, everything else goes away too. A lot of guys right now are worried about their pension. Guys my age or even quite younger are sweating it out that if we don't play baseball, how's this pension going to get funded? And I've been getting a check every month, and so there's some sweat going on between the retired players, but. It's the old story. Unions and management have always had trouble feeling like they were on the same side. The one's the enemy, depending on which chair you're sitting in. But what's happening now with this virus is such a strange way to have to calculate what to do. You could be open too fast, or if you're not open fast enough, things go away, and so it's such an uncertain time. I don't think there's any pat answer, except that the main thing is the sport itself has to be happening. If the sport goes away, all the good fringes about the sport, they also go away. So they must find a way, I think, this year to finish a season so we can have a playoff and a World Series and an All-Star game, because all those funding things are what makes the salaries big. It's what makes the pension. You know, I was a player representative for almost a decade with the Dodgers, and I was one of the early people fortunate to be in on the new monies from television coming into baseball, and the owners agreed with the player reps to allow 60% of the new revenues from television to be used for a pension plan, because baseball really had no pension plan until about the 1950s. And so I was very proud, and I'm not bragging about it, but I'm very, very proud that I was a small part as a player representative in those years to get the pension plan set up that's used today. But it's funded by revenues from the All-Star Game and the World Series. So that would affect a lot of players. About 6,000, there's about 6,000 players and former players that are covered by the pension plan. And that's a little bit uncertain right now if baseball doesn't get back together. So there's a lot of reasons why this sport, which is from my mail that I get, which has been heavy during this pandemic, there's a lot of deep interest for baseball, but we can't let it die on the vine.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So, anyway, no, I never didn't give you real answers, but there is a reality to this whole thing. The first thing is to get this virus under control and get a vaccine and all that. That'll clear up a lot of the concerns about what's going to happen. But as long as we're still in this limbo period of this virus is still around, it's still peeking up in different places, and there's still no certain path to victory here until somebody, like polio when I was a young guy,
mm-hmm.
polio was rampant in the world until Dr. Falk found a vaccine for it or whatever to control it. So we got to get to that point with this virus so everything else can take its place and go forward. In the baseball's case, it's just unreal to think that they could have sports with nobody in the stands. It just seems
right.
like it.
Well, one of the things the players keep mentioning is that, you know, they are kind of used to it on every level other than Major League Baseball. You know, whether it be high school, college, especially with the high school games when they're playing in, let's say, Wrigley Field, where there's hardly anybody, if anybody at all, for a
yeah.
championship game. And that's why they seem ready to go, just because they you know, whether it's Binghamton in the minor leagues or, you know, not everybody can play in Coney Island where it's 10,000 for every game.
Yeah, true. Well, that's a good observation, too. That is true. In high school, we hardly had anybody come to our ball game. At basketball games in Indiana, we might have 8,000 or 9,000 in attendance, but a high school baseball game, even some of the parents don't get there. But yeah, that's a good observation.
I want to, of course, we've got to get going. But just in terms of the union, it's a question that popped into my head that we could expand on so much another time. When it comes to the early years of a union being formed, and I have to reread everything. It's been a long time, but one of the things I remembered was that Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale were the ones who first looked for an agent. Now, do you think that may have not, you know, of course you had the Curt Flood thing, but with Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale, do you think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, with so many agents?
Yeah, it's a tough question for me because that I was not in the game at the time. You know, I played with Don Drysdale and Koufax for about 5 years, but they had their best years after I was already retired. And so, yeah, the agent was not around in my day. We negotiated for ourselves. Well, that's kind of what Don Drysdale and Sandy did, too. You know, they went in and as a team to talk to about their salaries. And that was well known that, of course, Bavese told me later that he gave Koufax a little bit higher what he asked for, and so he took $10,000 of the budget that O'Malley gave him to sign the players, and he gave Drysdale a little more, and O'Malley took it out of his pay. He said, "I hope Drysdale thank you because this comes out of your bonus." Yeah, anyway, yep. I'm not sure I answered your question, but
you gave a great insight one way or the other. You know, that just it does seem with them negotiating for themselves, they still had that backdrop of Hollywood. that might have added a little bit of thought process to going in there and furthering the player's power within the game. So that it's very interesting and something that I even though it doesn't necessarily compute in terms of the era that I'm going to be telling, it's still, you know, the foundations of what ended up happening with Marvin Miller certainly were planted within the era that we're discussing. So, Carl, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Excuse me for interrupting you. Came to mind to me that Bob Feller, pitching at Cleveland, he was one of the first players, I think the first player, to ever have incentives in his contract. And he's a good, smart businessman. He saw that on the days he pitched, the crowds were bigger. And so he began to negotiate with the owners at Cleveland that, hey, I want a piece of the action. When I pitch, I bring a lot of people to the ballpark. And so he was one of the first, I think the first player ever to have a contract that was an incentive based on how many people attended the games when he pitched above the average. And so, you know, Koufax and Drysdale would be in the same category. People found out who was pitching today, and it was Sandy or Don Drysdale. They're going to go to the ballpark. But I don't think they ever were able to negotiate based on actual attendance. But Feller, real early on, back in the 40s, he got a chunk of the attendance numbers, and I thought that was one of the smartest moves I ever heard of a ball player doing. But all contracts, all the way through my career, were 1 year. Never got, no player, no manager, until DeRocher, maybe in the mid-50s, got 2 years one time. But everybody was on a – Walt Olson managed the Dodgers for 24 years on one-year contracts.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that restricted a lot. You couldn't buy a house where you were playing. You couldn't build a 30-year mortgage on a one-year contract. So
yeah,
that's the way it was in those days. But – the union, you know, I was never around when the union was formed. And in fact, the player reps of my era, we rejected the opportunity to form a union. But the union itself, if a union sticks to what a union is really designed to do, is represent the worker and not get political and all the rest of it, the union's a good thing. It gives the players a voice, but the hammer is a strike, and I'm totally 100% opposed to a strike. How could it be okay in the law even that non-owners can shut down a business? That to me, that never should happen. But That's a deep subject, and you don't even talk about that at the dinner table. So,
right. Oh, it's gotten. You know, the divides have gotten worse and worse, and that's why we have these conversations for proper discourse and conversation to remind people that we can all be civil. And I understand why everything is so heightened, but you know, you just have to. As somebody who sometimes does have anger issues, you know, you just have to take a breath and remember to be without yourself, if you will, you know,
right.
Be within and without to look at your ego.
Well, I'm never opposed to unions because a voice for the worker is important. So they can do a lot of good things, and they did. For baseball, Don Fehr was ahead of the players' union after Marvin Miller, and I got to know Don Fehr quite well. And the union did a lot of good things for the players, and even the retired players benefited by the baseball union. So I don't have any ill feeling about union. If it's handled right, the voice of the worker is important. But I was never, my dad was a strong union man himself with General Motors, worked for 30 some years. But the union has to realize, as well as the owners, that the game itself is what keeps everything going. You can't beat up on the game for personal gain. You got to protect the game itself. And I think right now this unusual circumstance ought to bring the owners and players closer together, not divided.
And you know, we could really just talk about it nonstop, but you know, it goes back to that question of what the owners care about. I think that even if people have always questioned Walter O'Malley's his motivations for everything, I still think your era, most owners liked the game more than some of these owners now. And because a lot of the owners are looking at it as, all right, well, we're going to lose less money if we don't play. So some of them are considering taking the entire season off. But, and then you think, well, but you're not playing the long game, you think, and you want to say to them, but some of these guys don't even care about the long game. They just care about the dividends that are coming in year to year. And what I like to say to them as they wait for their billion-dollar profit to sell the team's not going to be worth anything if baseball isn't worth anything.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, you got to realize the fan base that supports baseball, the fan base ought to be considered here. What's it going to do to the fan base to have no season? They're not going to go away. Baseball has survived depressions and wars and everything else, but you got to protect the game. And it's not a guarantee that it'll always be here. You know, we think baseball's here forever. Oh, no. Two or three generations from now, if we have some kind of a downturn in interest and kids quit playing baseball and they all or something, survived a lot to stay here, but there's no guarantee that 50 years from now baseball might be history. You don't think it's true, but it is true. Did I lose you on that one, Sam? Hello.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.